You know, there are two places in the Old Testament that people get stuck in their daily Bible reading if they're undertaking that. And the first one is Leviticus, because the story kind of stops there. It just grinds to a halt. And you start reading about sacrifices and rituals, and people get stuck there, discouraged by the lack of a story and the abundance of details. But if you make it through Leviticus, it would not be unusual if you get stuck in Chronicles, especially if you make it through the first nine chapters, which are all genealogies, you know, all those names that nobody can pronounce. And if you use the King James Version, it's all that begetting. Someone said it is as if all the people did was begat. And then after the genealogies, you get into chapter 10, and you think you've found the book of Kings again. Like, didn't we just work our way through Kings? And it seems like it's about the same. And so people get stuck at the book of Chronicles. And we miss, if we do that, we miss the contribution that these books make to the Old Testament and to the big picture as a whole. And I'm going to be dealing with the books together tonight, because originally they were one book, and just for the sake of length and because of convenience, they have been divided into two. And I make a plea with you to let the books speak for themselves and to contribute to our journey through the Bible. Chronicles is one of the two books in the Bible to cover all of human history from creation to the day of the writer who was writing the book. The span is from creation to the day that he was writing the book. Both Matthew in the New Testament and Chronicles in the Old Testament do this, and both of them employ genealogies to do it. I had a friend once who I used to walk with on a regular basis, and he would describe his wife's conversation sometimes, and he would note that anything she says, she always begins at Adam. Well, that's what the writer of Chronicles did, and that's what Matthew does also. They begin with Adam. Evidence in the book indicates that the writer lived a little while after the exile. For example, in chapter 36 of 2 Chronicles, he reports the decree of Cyrus, so that would place him after the exile. And he traces the genealogy of David's royal line after the return to at least two generations past Zerubbabel. And Zerubbabel is one of the leaders who brought back a group from exile to Jerusalem. And so he traces the genealogy two generations beyond that in 1 Chronicles chapter 3. So what he does, in a sense, is he chronicles all of sacred history up to his own day. And as with all books of the Bible, we must do this with all the books of the Bible, he has a definite agenda that he wants to accomplish and a specific message that he wants to convey. So our job tonight is to see what he's doing and why he's doing it, and let the message of the book come through. And when we do that, I think you will find it interesting, intriguing, and I hope inspiring and helpful. Well, let's begin by thinking for just a moment about Chronicles' place in Scripture. And the reason I would bring that up is because it has a different spot or place in the Hebrew Bible, that is the Bible the Jews use, and our English Bibles. The Hebrew Bible is divided into three types of books, three divisions: law, prophets, and writings. And that's reflected in Luke 24, verse 44, when Jesus said, "All things that are written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled." He called it the Psalms. It's also called writings. So what Jesus is saying is that he is found in all parts, in all types of books, every book in the Old Testament. Our English Bibles are divided in a different way. We have four divisions: law, and you could ask some of our children this and they would know it, law, history, poetry, and prophets. And Chronicles finds its place in our English Bible in the history division, immediately after 1 and 2 Kings and just prior to Ezra and Nehemiah. And that position may explain in part the general neglect and the misunderstanding of Chronicles. Because reading that way, we read right out of Kings into Chronicles and think it's about the same stuff. And so we don't read carefully, or we don't read at all. And if we read, we may be so influenced by what we have just read in Kings that we misread Chronicles and we don't see its distinctive message. We can read the book as history. That is not incorrect to do that. But it is important to understand that it is not the same kind of history as Kings. It is a specific kind of history, as we will see in the course of our lesson. If we read it as straight history, we'll come away with some questions like, was the historian accurate, or did he distort his message? So I just want to make you aware of the different positions that the book has in different Bibles. Not because one is wrong and the other is right. That's not the case, because God didn't give an order to the books. They've been arranged by human beings. But we should be aware that the book's position may influence the way we read it. That's what I want us to see. And just because it falls in the history section of our English Bibles does not mean it is the same type of history as Samuel, Kings, and other such books. We can overcome that position if we allow the book to accomplish its purpose in the way the writer intended and not try to press it through some other mold. Now I want us to turn our attention to the scope and the contents of Chronicles. I've tried to present in each case in our stop on our Route 66 journey a little outline of the books, just to give you an idea of the contents. If you'll look at the chart behind me, genealogies in 1 Chronicles 1 to 9. Then David's reign as king, 1 Chronicles chapters 10 through 29. Solomon's reign, 2 Chronicles 1 to 9. And then the reign of other kings, or the kingdom of Judah, 2 Chronicles 10 through 36. So take a look at that, and we're going to deal with each of those sections and just a few details, because that will help us to understand the overall scope of the book and the purpose of the writer. So let's think first about the genealogies. Those are, some to us, some of the most uninteresting and probably some of the most unappreciated parts of the Old Testament. That would not be true of a Jew for a variety of reasons. Chronicles, as I mentioned, is one of those books that covers all of human history from creation to the writer's day, as does Matthew in the New Testament. So notice what the writer does with this genealogies. He traces the roots from Adam to Israel, from Adam to Israel in chapter 1. Then he looks at the tribes of Israel in chapters 2 to 8. And then specifically at the families who are returning after the exile, from the exile to their homeland in chapter 9. So let me make a few observations about that. First, notice the broader perspective. Samuel, I'm thinking about the book of Samuel. The book of Samuel begins at the close of the Judges period in Israel and introduces us to the kings of Israel. Then the books of 1 and 2 Kings picks up where Samuel ends and carries us through the kings of both Israel and Judah, the divided kingdom, first Saul, David, and Solomon in the United Kingdom, and then the divided kingdom, kings of Israel and kings of Judah, all the way through to the exile of the northern kingdom to Assyria and the southern kingdom to Babylon. Kings closes with a paragraph that is a scene that is dated to the 37th year of the exile. Now, Chronicles covers about the same period of time, basically the same subjects from the united and the divided kingdoms through to the Babylonian exile. But when you take a closer look and realize that the writer traces it back to the patriarchs and then beyond that all the way to Adam, you have to conclude that he has a broader perspective. And what he is doing, it seems, is establishing continuity of the restoration community, those people who had returned from exile. He is establishing continuity of those people to Israel of old, to the patriarchs, and even all the way back to Adam. So he establishes the continuity of those people and their connection with the past. They have history, they have roots, they have relevance because of that. So that's the broader perspective. Number two, he includes all Israel in the genealogies. By that I mean, in chapters 2 through 8, he includes genealogies of people from all tribes, the northern tribes as well as the southern tribes, all tribes except two, Zebulun and Dan. He does not include them. But apparently, he is saying about the divided kingdom that it was temporary and it was not desirable. That's not really what God wanted. It was a result of Solomon's sins. And so all Israel, not just the southern tribes, but all Israel had connection with the past, is what he would be saying. And then finally, about this matter, I would say, as uninteresting and as unnecessary that these appear to us, and we just kind of read over them, they had great importance to those who had returned to their homeland. What they did is establish their identity. It gave them roots, and it reached back across the tragedy of the exile and demonstrated continuity with ancient Israel. When times were better, when relationship with God was clearer, that would be important for those people to reach back across the exile and across their problems to ancient Israel when things were better. So it enabled the returning exiles to believe that God's promises that had been made to their ancestors were still alive, that they could have hope that a descendant of David still would sit on David's throne, that hope was not dead, but it was still alive. It was an ancient promise that was made in the past, but it still had relevance and importance for people in that setting. So those things about the genealogies. Now let's turn to the period of the kings. And what really is impressive and stands out in his dealing with kings, especially with David and Solomon, is what he omits and what he includes. Now he acknowledges that he uses sources. And one of those sources would be the books of Samuel and Kings. He refers to those as sources. And so that makes it possible for us to compare what he includes and what those books included, and then to draw some conclusions about what he omits and what he includes. For example, the writer of Chronicles says hardly anything about Saul. He includes Saul's genealogy in 1 Chronicles 9, 35 to 44, but he omits everything else about Saul, everything that's recorded in 1 Samuel chapters 9 to 30. Saul's mistakes, his string of sins, his paranoia in chasing David, and all of that is omitted by the writer of Chronicles. He does record in chapter 10, 1 Chronicles 10, verses 13 and 14, Saul's death. And specifically he says that Saul died at the hand of the Lord, that the Lord put Saul to death. Immediately he follows that with the account of David. For all practical purposes, in the mind of the writer of Chronicles, he portrays kingship in Israel as beginning with David. Now, technically, we know that it began with Saul. But theologically, I think all of us would have to agree, even from our study of Kings, that it begins with David, that he was the chosen one, that he was the man after God's own heart. And the writer of Chronicles does that for all practical purposes by just ignoring Saul almost entirely and going straight to David. Then it's important to know that almost everything he says about David is positive. He portrays David in almost an entirely positive light. He omits several episodes from David's life. All the things about David fleeing from Saul and all those related matters, the caves and all of those situations, he omits. He omits all of David's connections and conflicts with Saul's family, even some things he did good with Mephibosheth. Those are excluded, and with Saul's staff, such as Abner, the commander of his army. Most significantly, probably to us, the writer of Chronicles omits David's sin with Bathsheba and all the aftermath of that affair. And he omits David's charge to Solomon that he should take care of enemies that had been opposed to David that he had not taken care of. He gives instructions to Solomon how to dispose of those people so they will not be a threat to his kingship. So it's interesting and I think significant, as we'll notice in a moment, to see what he omits. It's also important to see what he includes. Almost every battle of David is included. All of these battles are not included in Kings, but all of the battles, it seems, that David fought are included. But one battle is omitted, and that is a battle in which David was almost killed. So David would be cast in a more negative light. The writer omits that, includes all the others. He gives extensive coverage to David in regard to building the temple. Now, David didn't actually build the temple. He planned to, and God said, no, his son would. But David spent a lot of time and effort and energy collecting all the materials to build the temple and drawing up the plans that were quite extensive. And he set in place the personnel that would serve in the temple, the gatekeepers and the singers and other staff members that would take care of matters in the temple. All that was arranged by David, and the writer of Chronicles is the only one who tells us about that. And then the succession between David and Solomon is presented in the book of Chronicles is almost without any glitches. Just a seamless, smooth transition from David to Solomon. And then Solomon takes over, and he is presented as in an entirely positive light. He has wisdom, especially when it comes to building the temple and dedicating the temple. And Solomon's marriages to foreign women and his encounters with various enemies who were opposed to him, all that is omitted from the book of Chronicles. So the conclusion that I would draw from that is that both David and Solomon are portrayed in Chronicles as glorious, obedient, as all-conquering. They enjoy the divine blessing, and they enjoy the support of the entire nation of Israel. So keep that in mind, that David and Solomon are portrayed in an entirely positive light. And we'll draw some conclusions about that in a moment, but let's take just a moment at the final section of the book of Chronicles, that about other kings. Now you'll remember in the book of Kings, there is an oscillation between the kings in the north and the kings in the south. And the writer presents that in a rather precise way by telling the time this king came to the throne, and it was the time when this king was reigning and so forth. And he evaluates their reign, especially as it relates to David. The writer of Chronicles does not do that. As a matter of fact, he records nothing about any of the northern kings. Now, many of you know that all the northern kings were wicked. Not one of them was good. He records nothing about the northern kings. And he records only selected things about selected southern kings. He focuses attention on 8 of the southern kings, all of who were of the line of David. He focuses attention on 8, and really of these 8, concentrates on 5, and he ignores 12 kings almost entirely. And he deliberately plays up these kings. He plays up these kings by, if there's anything good to say about them, anything at all, he says it. And if he can't say something good, he hardly says anything at all. So, in presenting the kings, he says things good, hardly says anything bad. In addition to what he says about David and Solomon in a positive light, he focuses especially on a few other kings, Jehoshaphat, Hezekiah, and Josiah. All of those 3 kings, those southern kings, were involved in spiritual reforms in Judah, and they were promoters of the temple. And so it seems that he singles them out and puts them in this positive light, especially because of their interest in spiritual reforms and in the temple. So you have to ask the question, what do we have going on here? Is the writer of Chronicles a bad historian? Does he gloss over important things? Is he distorting or skewing the picture of history? Well, the answer to all those questions is no. But he does tell history in a distinctive way, and he tells history for a special purpose. This is why This is why we must allow Kings and Chronicles to speak their own messages respectively and not read them in the same way. Now, just some general comments about history. All history writing has an angle. That is, the one who is presenting the history chooses certain events and certain personalities and presents them in particular ways, emphasizing certain things and not emphasizing other things, in order to tell the story as they understand it. The writer's themes that he has in mind, the purposes that he wants to accomplish, the needs of his readers, all these things might come to play, and they control the author's selection and presentation of the events. That's true of all history writing. And it is certainly true of what we see the chronicler doing. So let's think about the situation that he was addressing. I mentioned to you that he wrote after the exile, probably after some had returned. What had the readers gone through? What were they thinking? Well, they had experienced the destruction of Jerusalem. And they had experienced the end of the Davidic succession of kings. You know, God made this covenant with David that's recorded in 2 Samuel 7, as well as in Chronicles. And he said, I will establish your house forever. He acknowledges that some kings would not be the kings that they ought to be, and God would have to intervene. And what happened in reality is that the physical line of David's king, of David's kingship, came to an end. And there was exile. But now the exile had ended. Cyrus had made his decree, and some people had returned. And they had come under the leadership of Zerubbabel, who was a descendant of David. And there were high hopes for him that he might be the one, that he might be the Messiah. But that didn't seem to be panning out. So people were not asking about exile. How could this have happened to us, or why did it happen? They were not asking those questions. The books of Kings had already answered those questions. They were clear about their sins and failures, and why had it all happened. The more relevant questions for these people after the exile were these. Are we still the people of God? Because only a remnant returned. And the setting was not particularly good. And when the temple was rebuilt, it did not have nearly as much glory as the former one that Solomon had built, and all the riches that he had provided by his father David. So people would be asking, are we still the people of God? Did the exile end God's covenant with his people? Is it over? Is that it? Or they might be asking, what do God's promises to Israel, to Jerusalem, and to David that were made before the exile, what do they have to do with us today? Is there anything there for us about Israel and about Jerusalem and about David for us today? So what the chronicler does is prepare another history. There had been one history presented by the writers of Samuel and Kings to address certain questions, issues, and problems. Now the chronicler is presenting another history that addresses a different set of questions. At the moment, Israel's existence seemed to be quite precarious. They were at the mercy and the whims of Persian kings. A Persian king sent them back and gave them money and supported them. But all of that could vaporize, disappear on a moment's notice. And their enemies wanted that to happen and tried to persuade some of the kings to do that. So the nation was in danger of lapsing into a state of despair and lethargy and forget that they were divinely appointed by God to be a light to the nations. You know, that was God's purpose for his people, that others may know about their relationship with God. And really, Israel never fulfilled that to any great degree. They did not need to be reminded of the internal strife and the sin that brought on the exile. They knew that well. They had had 70 years to reflect on that, to beat themselves up about that and feel bad about that. They needed to be reminded. They needed to be reminded of the glorious destiny that had been promised to them. They needed to see history in a way that would assure and inspire them. They needed to see history in a way that would turn their eyes and turn their hearts away from their miserable present condition that was not everything they wanted it to be, toward the future. They needed their eyes and hearts turned toward the future, and more specifically to the promised Messiah, to the descendant of David who would sit on the throne in the best and greatest possible way, the ultimate fulfillment of the covenant with David. So I would say what the writer of Chronicles was doing was not idolizing I-D-O-L, not idolizing kings or history, but he was idealizing, I-D-E-A-L. He was idealizing them. He wrote of an idealized past to provide a picture for a hopeful future. Key idea in understanding Chronicles. He wrote a picture of an idealized past in order to present a picture for a hopeful future. He most wonderfully portrayed David of the past for the purpose of building hope for the David of the future. That's what his readers needed, and that's what he wanted to provide. The bigger picture, what is this book saying about God? What is it saying to us today? Well, it's saying that God doesn't forget his promises to his people. It might look like it at times. We all face situations and circumstances at times that maybe make us question God's faithfulness, his kindness, and his goodness. Nothing new. People have thought about that, faced that. And what we're reminded of is that God doesn't forget his promises. He can bring glory even out of despair. Those people needed to know that God was still with them, that he had not forgotten them, and that he would continue to be with them, but they must be with him. That's what the writer was wanting to accomplish, not only to assure them that God would be with them, but encourage them that they must be with him. They must trust him, and they must hope in him. So the result of that is to obey him and to be faithful to him in every way. And that makes the message of the book so relevant and important for us today. We live after the Messiah, after the one who sat on the throne of David, and all the great accomplishments that he did for us. But the principle of our relationship is still the same. And that is, we must trust him, and we must hope in him. And that'll carry us through whatever comes our way. Whatever difficulty, whatever problem, whatever doubt, whatever question comes our way, that'll see us through and encourage us to trust and obey and be faithful to our God. So I hope you see now that these neglected books of the Old Testament, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, that sometimes get us stuck in our Bible reading, are extremely valuable. They are important stops on our Route 66, our journey through the Bible. I hope you will read them if you haven't. And anytime you're doing Bible reading, don't get stuck at those wonderful books. Just read them as the author intended for them to be read and understand their wonderful purpose for us. Well, I want to extend the Lord's invitation to us in the closing moments. I think one wonderful thing about this Route 66 journey is that it just puts a lot of things in perspective, and you get a lot of things sorted out and ordered in your mind, and you begin to see the bigger picture of what God is all about. We look at him narrowly at times, and thus we have questions and doubts and problems with him. When you look at the bigger picture and his track record, you have to be impressed with all he has done, how true he's been, and how gracious he is. Don't you want to follow a God like that? the one who gave his son, who gave his life, so that we can have relationship with God and life eternal. So, in our little stop in Chronicles tonight, I hope you're encouraged to be the person of God that he has made it possible for us to be through the one who sat on David's throne in the most wonderful and fullest way. Would you follow Jesus and be joined with him and be faithful to him? If we can help you with that, we want to. I'll be at the front. We're all standing to sing to encourage each other to do just that right now. Let's stand and sing.